Chapter 3. In a bar hard by PP Layouts, Richard Hanat sat sipping a tequila sour, his display case on the table before him. He knew goddamn well there was nothing wrong with Emily's pots. Her work was saleable. The problem had to do with her ex-husband and his position of power, and Barney Mayerson had exercised that power. "I have to call Emily and tell her," Hanat said to himself. He started to his feet. A man blocked his way, a peculiar round specimen mounted on spindly legs. "Who are you?" Hanat said. The man bobbed toy-like in front of him, meanwhile digging into his pocket as if scratching at a familiar microorganism that possessed parasitic proclivities that had survived the test of time. However, what he produced at last was a business card.
"We're interested in your ceramic ware, Mr. Hat. Nat, however you say it."
"Ickholtz," Hanat said, reading the card. It gave only the name, no further info, not even a VID number. "But what I have with me are just samples. I'll give you the names of retail outlets stocking our line, but these
are for minning,"
the toy-like man, Mr. Ickholtz, said, nodding.
"And that's what we want. We intend to min your ceramics, Mr. Hanat. We believe that Mayerson is wrong. They will become fash, and very soon."
Hanat stared at him. "You want to min, and you're not from PP Layouts?" But no one else minned. Everyone knew PP Layouts had a monopoly. Seating himself at the table beside the display case, Mr. Ickholtz brought out his wallet and began counting out skins.
"Very little publicity will be attached to this at first, but eventually..."
He offered Hanat the stack of brown, wrinkled truffle skins which served as tender in the Sol system. The only molecule, a unique protein amino acid, which could not be duplicated by the printers, the biltong life forms employed in place of automated assembly lines by many of Terra's industries.
"I'll have to check with my wife," Hanat said.
"Aren't you the representative of your firm?"
"Yes."
He accepted the pile of skins.
"The contract."
Ickholtz produced a document, spread it flat on the table. He extended a pen.
"It gives us an exclusive."
As he bent to sign, Richard Hanat saw the name of Ickholtz's firm on the contract. Choosee Manufacturers of Boston. He had never heard of them. Choosee. It reminded him of another product, exactly which he could not recall. It was only after he had signed and Ickholtz was tearing loose his copy that he remembered. The illegal hallucinogenic drug Candy, used in the colonies in conjunction with the Perkypat Layouts. He had an intuition compounded by deep unease, but it was too late to back out. Ickholtz was gathering up the display case. The contents belonged to Choosee Manufacturers of Boston, USA, Terra, now.
"How can I get in touch with you?"
Hanat asked, as Ickholtz started away from the table.
"You won't be getting in touch with us. If we want you, we'll call you."
Ickholtz smiled briefly. How in hell was he going to tell Emily? Hanat counted the skins, read the contract, realized by degrees exactly how much Ickholtz had paid him. It was enough to provide him and Emily with a 5-day vacation in Antarctica, at one of the great, cool resort cities frequented by the rich of Terra, where no doubt Leo Bolero and others like him spent the summer. And these days, summer lasted all year round. Or, he pondered, it could do even more. It could get himself and his wife into the most exclusive establishment on the planet, assuming he and Emily wanted it. They could fly to the Germanies and enter one of Dr. Willy Denkmal's e-therapy clinics. Wowee, he thought. He shut himself up in the bar's vidphone booth and called Emily.
"Pack your bag. We're going to Munich to..."
He picked the name of a clinic at random. He had seen this one advertised in exclusive Paris magazines.
"To Eichenwald," he told her. "Dr. Denkmal is..."
"Bonnie took them,"
Emily said.
"No, but there's someone else in the field of minning now besides PP Layouts."
He felt elated.
"So Barney turned us down. So what? We did better with his new outfit. They must have plenty. I'll see you in half an hour. I'll arrange for accommodations on TWA's express flight. Think of it. E-therapy for both of us."
In a low voice, Emily said,
"I'm not sure I want to evolve when it comes right down to it."
Staggered, he said,
"Sure you do.
I mean, it could save our lives, and if not ours, then our kids, our potential kids, that we might be having someday. And even if we're only there a short time and only evolve a little, look at the doors it'll open to us. We'll be personae grati everywhere. Do you personally know anyone who's had e-therapy? You read about so-and-so in the homeopaths all the time, society people, but...
I don't want that hair all over me, Emily said. And I don't want to have my head expand.
No, I won't go to Eichenwald Clinic. She sounded completely decided. Her face was placid. He said, Then I'll go alone. It would still be of economic value. After all, it was he who dealt with buyers. And he could stay at the clinic twice as long, evolve twice as much, assuming that the treatments took. Some people did not respond, but that was hardly Dr. Denkmal's fault. The capacity for evolution was not bestowed on everyone alike. About himself, he felt certitude. He'd evolve remarkably, catch up with the big shots, even pass some of them, in terms of the familiar horny rind which Emily, out of mistaken prejudice, had called hair.
What am I supposed to do while you're gone? Just make pots?
Right, he said, because orders would be arriving thick and fast. Otherwise, choosy manufacturers of Boston would have no interest in the men. Obviously, they employed their own prefash precogs as PP layouts did. But then he remembered, Ickholtz had said very little publicity at first. That meant, he realized, that the new firm had no network of disc jockeys circling the colony moons and planets. Unlike PP layouts, they had no Alan and Charlotte Fane to flash the news to. But it took time to set up disc jockey satellites. This was natural. And yet, it made him uneasy. He thought all at once in panic, could they be an illegal firm? Maybe choosy, like candy, is banned. Maybe I've got us into something dangerous. Choosy, he said aloud to Emily. Ever heard of it?
No.
He got the contract out and once more examined it. What a mess, he thought. How'd I get into it? If only that damn Mayerson had said yes on the pots. At 10 in the morning, a terrific horn, familiar to him, hooted Sam Regan out of his sleep, and he cursed the UN ship upstairs. He knew the racket was deliberate. The ship, circling above the hovel chicken-pox prospects, wanted to be certain that colonists, and not merely indigenous animals, got the parcels that were to be dropped. We'll get them, Sam Regan muttered to himself as he zipped his insulated overalls, put his feet into high boots, and then grumpily sauntered as slowly as possible toward the ramp.
He's early today, Todd Morris complained. And I'll bet it's all staples, sugar, and food basics like lard. Nothing interesting, such as, say, candy.
Putting his shoulders against the lid at the top of the ramp, Norman Shine pushed. Bright cold sunlight spilled down on them, and they blinked. The UN ship sparkled overhead, set against the black sky as if hanging from an uneasy thread. Good pilot, this drop, Todd decided. Knows the Feinberg Crescent area. He waved at the UN ship, and once more the huge horn burst out its din, making him clap his hands to his ears. A projectile slid from the underpart of the ship, extended stabilizers, and spiraled toward the ground.
Shoot, Sam Regan said with disgust. It is Staples. They don't have the parachute.
He turned away, not interested. How miserable the upstairs looked today, he thought as he surveyed the landscape of Mars. Dreary. Why did we come here? Had to. We're forced to. Already the UN projectile had landed, its hull cracked open, torn by the impact, and the three colonists could see canisters. It looked to be 500 pounds of salt. Sam Regan felt even more despondent.
Hey, Shine said, walking toward the projectile and peering. I believe I see something we can use. Looks like radios in those boxes, Todd said. Transistor radios.
Thoughtfully, he followed after Shine.
Maybe we can use them for something new in our layouts.
Mine's already got a radio, Shine said.
Well, build an electronic self-directing lawnmower with the parts, Todd said. You don't have that, do you?
He knew the Shine's Perky Path layout fairly well. The two couples, he and his wife, with Shine and his, had fused together a good deal, being compatible. Sam Regan said,
Dibs on the radios, because I can use them.
His layout lacked the automatic garage door opener that both Shine and Todd had. He was considerably behind them. Of course, all those items could be purchased, but he was out of skins. He had used his complete supply in the service of a need which he considered more pressing. He had, from a pusher, bought a fairly large quantity of candy. It was buried, hidden out of sight, in the earth under his sleep compartment at the bottom level of their collective hovel. He himself was a believer. He affirmed the miracle of translation, the near sacred moment in which the miniature artifacts of the layout no longer merely represented Earth, but became Earth. And he and the others, joined together in the fusion of doll inhabitation by means of the candy, were transported outside of time and local space. Many of the colonists were as yet unbelievers. To them, the layouts were merely symbols of a world which none of them could any longer experience. But, one by one, the unbelievers came around. Even now, so early in the morning, he yearned to go back down below, chew a slice of candy from his hoard, and join with his fellows in the most solemn moment of which they were capable. To Todd and Norm Schein, he said,
"Either of you care to seek transit?"
That was the technical term they used for participation.
"I'm going back below," he said. "We can use my candy. I'll share it with you."
An inducement like that could not be ignored. Both Todd and Norm looked tempted.
"So early?"
Norm Schein said.
"We just got out of bed. But I guess there's nothing to do anyhow."
He kicked glumly at a huge semi-autonomic sand dredge. It had remained parked near the entrance of the hovel for days now. No one had the energy to come up to the surface and resume the clearing operations inaugurated earlier in the month.
"It seems wrong, though," he muttered. "We ought to be up here working in our gardens."
"And that's some garden you've got," Sam Regan said with a grin.
"What is that stuff you've got growing there? Got a name for it?"
Norm Schein, hands in the pockets of his coveralls, walked over the sandy, loose soil with its sparse vegetation to his once carefully maintained vegetable garden. He paused to look up and down the rows, hopeful that more of the specially prepared seeds had sprouted. None had.
"Swiss chard," Todd said encouragingly. "Right? Mutated as it is, I can still recognize the leaves."
Breaking off a leaf, Norm chewed it, then spat it out. The leaf was bitter and coated with sand. Now Helen Morris emerged from the hovel, shivering in the cold Martian sunlight.
"We have a question," she said to the three men. "I say that psychoanalysts back on Earth were charging $50 an hour, and Fran says it was for only 45 minutes.
She explained,
"We want to add an analyst to our layout, and we want to get it right, because it's an authentic item made on Earth and shipped here. If you remember that Bolero ship that came by last week."
"We remember," Norm Schein said sourly. The prices that the Bolero salesman had wanted, and all the time, in their satellite, Alan and Charlotte Fane talked up the different items so, whetting everyone's appetite.
"Ask the Fanes," Helen's husband Todd said. "Radio them the next time the satellite passes over."
He glanced at his wristwatch. "In another hour. They have all the data on authentic items. In fact, that particular datum should have been included with the item itself, right in the carton." It perturbed him, because it had, of course, been his skins, his and Ellen's together, that had gone to pay for the tiny figure of the human-type psychoanalyst, including the couch, desk, carpet, and bookcase of incredibly well-minned, impressive books.
"You went to the analyst when you were still on Earth," Helen said to Norm Schein. "What was the charge?"
"Well, I mostly went to group therapy," Norm said, "at the Berkeley State Mental Hygiene Clinic, and they charged according to your ability to pay. And, of course, Perky Pat and her boyfriend go to a private analyst." He walked down the length of the garden, solemnly deeded to him, between the rows of jagged leaves, all of which were to some extent shredded and devoured by microscopic native pests. If he could find one healthy plant, one untouched, it would be enough to restore his spirits. Insecticides from Earth simply had not done the job here. The native pests thrived. They had been waiting 10,000 years, biding their time, for someone to appear and make an attempt to raise crops. Todd said,
"You better do some watering."
"Yeah," Norm Schein agreed. He meandered gloomily in the direction of Chickenpox Prospect's hydro-pumping system. It was attached to their now partially sand-filled irrigation network which served all the gardens of their hovel. Before watering came sand removal, he realized. If they didn't get the big Class A dredge started up soon, they wouldn't be able to water even if they wanted to. But he did not particularly want to.
And yet he could not, like Sam Regan, simply turn his back on the scene up there, return below to fiddle with his layout, build or insert new items, make improvements, or, as Sam proposed, actually get out a quantity of the carefully hidden candy and begin the communication. We have responsibilities, he realized. To Helen, he said, "Ask my wife to come up here." She could direct him as he operated the dredge. Fran had a good eye.
"I'll get her,"
Sam Regan agreed, starting back down below. "No one wants to come along?" No one followed him. Todd and Helen Morris had gone over to inspect their own garden now, and Norm Schein was busy pulling the protective wrapper from the dredge, preparatory to starting it up. Back below, Sam Regan hunted up Fran Schein. He found her crouched at the perky pat layout, which the Morrises and the Shines maintained together, intent on what she was doing. Without looking up, Fran said,
"We've got Perky Pat all the way downtown in her new Ford hardtop convert, and parked and a dime in the meter, and she shopped, and now she's in the analyst's office reading fortune. But what does she pay?"
She glanced up, smoothed back her long, dark hair, and smiled at him. Beyond a doubt, Fran was the handsomest and most dramatic person in their collective hovel. He observed this now, and not for anything like the first time. He said,
"How can you fuss with that layout and not chew?"
He glanced around. The two of them appeared to be alone. Bending down, he said softly to her,
"Come on, and we'll chew some first-rate candy, like you and I did before, okay?"
His heart labored as he waited for her to answer. Recollections of the last time the two of them had been translated in unison made him feel weak.
"Helen Morris will be..."
"No, they're cranking up the dredge above. They won't be back down for an hour."
He took hold of Fran by the hand, led her to her feet. "What arrives in a plain brown wrapper," he said as he steered her from the compartment out into the corridor,
"should be used, not just buried. It gets old and stale, loses its potency."
"And we pay a lot for that potency," he thought morbidly. "Too much to let it go to waste. Although some, not in this hovel, claimed that the power to ensure translation did not come from the candy, but from the accuracy of the layout. To him, this was a nonsensical view, and yet it had its adherents. As they hurriedly entered Sam Regan's compartment, Fran said,
"I'll chew in unison with you, Sam, but let's not do anything while we're there on Terra that, you know, we wouldn't do here. I mean, just because we're Pat and Walt and not ourselves, that doesn't give us license."
She gave him a warning frown, reproving him for his former conduct and for leading her to that yet unasked.
"Then you admit we really go to Earth."
They had argued this point, and it was cardinal, many times in the past. Fran tended to take the position that the translation was one of appearance only, of what the colonists called accidents, the mere outward manifestations of the places and objects involved, not the essences.
"I believe," Fran said slowly, as she disengaged her fingers from his and stood by the hall door of the compartment, "that whether it's a play of imagination, of drug-induced hallucination, or an actual translation from Mars to Earth as it was, by an agency we know nothing of..."
Again she eyed him sternly.
"I think we should abstain, in order not to contaminate the experience of communication."
As she watched him carefully remove the metal bed from the wall, and reach with an elongated hook into the cavity revealed, she said,
"It should be a purifying experience. We lose our fleshly bodies, our corporeality, as they say, and put on imperishable bodies instead, for a time, anyhow. Or forever, if you believe, as some do, that it's outside of time and space, that it's eternal. Don't you agree, Sam?"
She sighed.
"I know you don't."
"Spirituality," he said with disgust, as he fished up the packet of candy from its cavity beneath the compartment. "A denial of reality. And what do you get instead? Nothing."
"I admit," Fran said as she came closer to watch him open the packet, "that I can't prove you get anything better back, due to abstention. But I do know this. What you and other sensualists among us don't realize is that when we chew candy and leave our bodies, we die. And by dying we lose the weight of..."
She hesitated.
"Say it,"
Sam said as he opened the packet. With a knife, he cut a strip from the mass of brown, tough, plant-like fibers. Fran said,
"Sin."
Sam Regan howled with laughter.
Okay, at least you're orthodox.
Because most colonists would agree with Fran.
But,
he said, redepositing the packet back in its safe place,
that's not why I chew it. I don't want to lose anything. I want to gain something.
He shut the door of the compartment, then swiftly got out his own perky path layout, spread it on the floor, and put each object in place, working at eager speed.
Something to which we're not normally entitled, he added, as if Fran didn't know.
Her husband, or his wife, or both of them, or everyone in the entire hovel, could show up while he and Fran were in the state of translation, and their two bodies would be seated at proper distance one from the other. No wrongdoing could be observed, however prurient the observers were. Legally, this had been ruled on. No cohabitation could be proved, and legal experts among the ruling UN authorities on Mars and the other colonies had tried and failed. While translated, one could commit incest, murder, anything, and it remained from a juridical standpoint a mere fantasy, an impotent wish only. This highly interesting fact had long inured him to the use of candy. For him, life on Mars had few blessings.
I think, Fran said, you're tempting me to do wrong.
As she seated herself, she looked sad, her eyes, large and dark, fixed futilely on a spot at the center of the layout, near Perky Pat's enormous wardrobe. Absently, Fran began to fool with a mink sable coat, not speaking. He handed her half of a strip of candy, then popped his own portion into his mouth and chewed greedily. Still looking mournful, Fran also chewed. He was Walt. He owned a Jaguar XXB sports ship with a flat-out velocity of 15,000 miles an hour. His shirts came from Italy, and his shoes were made in England. As he opened his eyes, he looked for the little GE clock TV set by his bed. It would be on automatically, tuned to the morning show of the great news clown Jim Briskin. In his flaming red wig, Briskin was already forming on the screen. Walt sat up, touched a button which swung his bed, altered to support him in a sitting position, and lay back to watch for a moment the program in progress.
"I'm standing here at the corner of Van Ness and Market in downtown San Francisco," Briskin said pleasantly, "and we're just about to view the opening of the exciting new subsurface CONAP building, Sir Francis Drake, the first to be entirely underground. With us to dedicate the building, standing right by me, is that enchanting female of ballad and—"
Walt shut off the TV, rose, and walked barefoot to the window. He drew the shades, saw out then onto the warm, sparkling early morning San Francisco street, the hills and white houses. This was Saturday morning, and he did not have to go to his job down in Palo Alto at Ampex Corporation. Instead, and this rang nicely in his mind, he had a date with his girl, Pat Christensen, who had a modern little apt over on Potrero Hill. It was always Saturday. In the bathroom, he splashed his face with water, then squirted on shave cream and began to shave. And, while he shaved, staring into the mirror at his familiar features, he saw a note tacked up in his own hand. "This is an illusion. You are Sam Regan, a colonist on Mars. Make use of your time of translation, buddy boy. Call up Pat pronto." And the note was signed, Sam Regan. An illusion, he thought, pausing in his shaving. In what way? He tried to think back. Sam Regan and Mars, a dreary colonist's hovel. Yes, he could dimly make the image out, but it seemed remote and vitiated and not convincing. Shrugging, he resumed shaving, puzzled now and a little depressed. All right, suppose the note was correct. Maybe he did remember that other world, that gloomy quasi-life of involuntary expatriation in an unnatural environment. So what? Why did he have to wreck this? Reaching, he yanked down the note, crumpled it, and dropped it into the bathroom disposal chute. As soon as he had finished shaving, he vidphoned Pat.
"Listen,"
she said at once, cool and crisp. On the screen, her blonde hair shimmered. She had been drying it.
"I don't want to see you, Walt. Please, because I know what you have in mind, and I'm just not interested. Do you understand?"
Her blue-gray eyes were cold.
"Hmm," he said, shaken, trying to think of an answer. "But it's a terrific day. We ought to get outdoors. Visit Golden Gate Park, maybe."
"It's going to be too hot to go outdoors."
"No,"
he disagreed, nettled.
That's later. Hey, we could walk along the beach, splash around on the waves. Okay?
She wavered visibly.
But that conversation we had just before...
There was no conversation. I haven't seen you in a week, not since last Saturday.
He made his tone as firm and full of conviction as possible.
I'll drop by your place in half an hour and pick you up. Wear your swimsuit, you know, the yellow one, the Spanish one that has a halter.
Oh, she said disdainfully, that's completely out of fashion now. I have a new one from Sweden. You haven't seen it. I'll wear that, if it's permitted. The girl at A&F wasn't sure.
It's a deal, he said and rang off.
A half hour later, in his Jaguar, he landed on the elevated field of her Connaught building. Pat wore a sweater and slacks. The swimsuit, she explained, was on underneath. Carrying a picnic basket, she followed him up the ramp to his parked ship. Eager and pretty, she hurried ahead of him, pattering along in her sandals. It was all working out as he had hoped. This was going to be a swell day after all, after his initial trepidations had evaporated, as thank God they had.
Wait until you see this swimsuit, she said as she slid into the parked ship, the basket on her lap. It's really daring. It hardly exists. Actually, you sort of have to have faith to believe in it.
As he got in beside her, she leaned against him.
I've been thinking over that conversation we had. Let me finish.
She put her fingers against his lips, silencing him.
I know it took place, Walt. But in a way, you're right. In fact, basically, you have the proper attitude. We should try to obtain as much from this as possible. Our time is short enough as it is. At least so it seems to me.
She smiled wanly.
So drive as fast as you can. I want to get to the ocean.
Almost at once, they were setting down in the parking lot at the edge of the beach.
It's going to be hotter, Pat said soberly. Every day, isn't it? Until finally it's unbearable.
She tugged off her sweater, then, shifting about on the seat of the ship, managed to struggle out of her slacks.
But we won't live that long. It'll be another 50 years before no one can go outside at noon. Like they say, become mad dogs and Englishmen. We're not that yet.
She opened the door and stepped out in her swimsuit. And she had been correct. It took faith in things unseen to make the suit out at all. It was perfectly satisfactory to both of them. Together, he and she plodded along the wet, hard-packed sand, examining jellyfish, shells, and pebbles, the debris tossed up by the waves.
What year is this?
Pat asked him suddenly, halting. The wind blew her untied hair back. It lifted in a mass of cloud-like yellow, clear and bright and utterly clean, each strand separate.
He said, Well, I guess it's...
And then he could not recall. It eluded him.
Damn, he said crossly.
Well, it doesn't matter.
Linking arms with him, she trudged on.
Look, there's that little secluded spot ahead, past those rocks.
She increased her tempo of motion. Her body rippled as her strong, taut muscles strained against the wind and the sand and the old familiar gravity of a world lost long ago.
Am I what's her name? Fran?
She asked suddenly. She stepped past the rocks. Foam and water rolled over her feet, her ankles. Laughing, she leaped, shivered from the sudden chill.
Or am I Patricia Christensen?
With both hands, she smoothed her hair.
This is blonde, so I must be Pat, Perky Pat.
She disappeared beyond the rocks. He quickly followed, scrambling after her.
I used to be Fran, she said over her shoulder, but that doesn't matter now. I could have been anyone before, Fran or Helen or Mary, and it wouldn't matter now, right?
No, he disagreed, catching up with her. Panting, he said, It's important that you're Fran, in essence.
In essence?
She threw herself down on the sand, lay resting on her elbow, drawing, by means of a sharp black rock, in savage swipes which left deeply gouged lines. Almost at once, she tossed the rock away and sat around to face the ocean.
But the accidents, they're Pat.
She put her hands beneath her breasts then, languidly lifting them, a puzzled expression on her face.
These, she said, are Pat's, not mine. Mine are smaller, I remember.
He seated himself beside her, saying nothing.
We're here, she said presently, to do what we can't do back at the hovel. back where we've left our corruptible bodies. As long as we keep our layouts in repair, this...
She gestured at the ocean, then once more touched herself, unbelievingly.
It can't decay, can it? We've put on immortality.
All at once she lay back, flat against the sand, and shut her eyes, one arm over her face.
And since we're here, and we can do things denied us at the hovel, then your theory is we ought to do those things. We ought to take advantage of the opportunity.
He leaned over her, bent, and kissed her on the mouth. Inside his mind, a voice thought,
But I can do this any time.
And in the limbs of his body, an alien mastery asserted itself. He sat back, away from the girl.
After all, Normshine thought, I'm married to her.
He laughed then.
Who said you could use my layout?
Sam Regan thought angrily.
Get out of my compartment, and I bet it's my candy, too.
You offered it to us, the co-inhabitant of his mind-body answered. So I decided to take you up on it.
I'm here, too, Todd Morris thought. And if you want my opinion...
Nobody asked you for yours, Normshine thought angrily. In fact, nobody asked you to come along. Why don't you go back up and mess with that run-down, no-good garden of yours where you ought to be?
Todd Morris thought calmly.
I'm with Sam. I don't get a chance to do this except here.
The power of his will combined with Sam's. Once more, Walt bent over the reclining girl. Once again, he kissed her on the mouth, and this time heavily, with increased agitation. Without opening her eyes, Pat said in a low voice,
I'm here, too. This is Helen.
She added,
And also Mary. But we're not using your supply of candy, Sam. We brought some we had already.
She put her arms around him as the three inhabitants of Perky Pat joined in unison in one endeavor. Taken by surprise, Sam Regan broke contact with Todd Morris. He joined the effort of Norm Shine, and Walt sat back away from Perky Pat. The waves of the ocean lapped at the two of them as they silently reclined together on the beach, two figures comprising the essences of six persons. Two and six, Sam Regan thought. The mystery repeated. How was it accomplished? The old question again. But all I care about, he thought, is whether they're using up my candy, and I bet they are. I don't care what they say, I don't believe them. Rising to her feet, Perky Pat said,
Well, I can see I might just as well go for a swim. Nothing's doing here.
She padded into the water, splashed away from them as they sat in their body, watching her go.
We missed our chance, Todd Morris thought wryly. My fault, Sam admitted.
By joining, he and Todd managed to stand. They walked a few steps after the girl, and then, ankle-deep in the water, halted. Already Sam Regan could feel the power of the drug wearing off. He felt weak and afraid and bitterly sickened at the realization. So goddamn soon, he said to himself. All over, back to the hovel, to the pit in which we twist and cringe like worms in a paper bag, huddled away from the daylight, pale and white and awful. He shuddered. Shuddered, and saw once more his compartment with its tinny bed, washstand, desk, kitchen stove, and, in slumped inert heaps, the empty husks of Todd and Helen Morris, Fran and Norm Shine, his own wife, Mary. Their eyes stared emptily, and he looked away, appalled. On the floor between them was his layout. He looked down and saw the dolls, Walt and Pat, placed at the edge of the ocean, near the park jaguar. Sure enough, Perky Pat had on the near-invisible Swedish swimsuit, and next to them reposed a tiny picnic basket, and, by the layout, a plain brown wrapper that had contained candy. The five of them had shot it out of existence, and even now, as he looked, against his will, he saw a thin trickle of shiny brown syrup emerge from each of their slack, willless mouths. Across from him, Fran Shine stirred, opened her eyes, moaned. She focused on him, then wearily sighed.
They got to us, he said.
We took too long.
She rose unsteadily, stumbled, and almost fell. At once he was up, too, catching hold of her.
You are right. We should have done it right away if we intended to, but...
She let him hold her briefly.
I like the preliminaries. Walking along the beach, showing you the swimsuit that is no swimsuit.
She smiled a little. Sam said,
They'll be out for a few more minutes, I bet.
Wide-eyed, Fran said,
Yes, you're right.
She skipped away from him to the door,
Tugging it open, she disappeared out into the hall.
"In our compartment," she called back. "Hurry!"
Pleased, he followed. It was too amusing. He was convulsed with laughter. Ahead of him, the girl scampered up the ramp to her level of the hovel. He gained on her, caught hold of her as they reached her compartment. Together they tumbled in, rolled giggling and struggling across the hard metal floor to bump against the far wall. "We won after all," he thought as he deftly unhooked her bra, began to unbutton her shirt, unzipped her skirt, and removed her laceless, slipper-like shoes in one swift operation. He was busy everywhere, and Fran sighed, this time not wearily. "I better lock the door." He rose, hurried to the door, and shut it, fastening it securely. Fran, meanwhile, struggled out of her undone clothes.
"Come back," she urged. "Don't just watch."
She piled them in a hasty heap, shoes on top like two paperweights. He descended back to her side, and her swift, clever fingers began on him. Dark eyes alit, she worked away to his delight. And right here, in their dreary abode on Mars, and yet, they had still managed it the old way, the soul way, through the drug brought in by the furtive pushers. Candy had made this possible. They continued to require it. In no way were they free. As Fran's knees clasped his bare sides, he thought, "And in no way do we want to be. In fact, just the opposite." As his hand traveled down her flat, quaking stomach, he thought, "We could even use a little more."